Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A. There will never be a way to fully comprehend the horror of the Holocaust, but we must never give up the struggle to do so. That millions of human beings could be ruthlessly exterminated because of their faith, their ethnicity, or their lifestyle is an indictment of all our proud notions of human progress. That this could happen in our century means that this is now a part of our common history, and we must be the guardians of remembrance, which is the only way that we can begin to hope that this evil will not be repeated. We can assure that remembrance through witness and through art, in words, in images, and in music. My guest is Donald McCullough, conductor of the Master Chorale of Washington and composer and arranger of the Holocaust Cantata. Donald, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you.
It's an honor to have you here, actually, because it's a wonderful piece of music. And we have before us, Donald, having mentioned the music, a work that is, in its conception, an act of memorialization. That's very, very clear. And it combines the narrative power of the survivor's words with the emotional force of the music composed and arranged. And it's clearly a work of scholarship. And with all of that in mind, I'm moved to ask you first, why did you undertake this project? What led you to something so grand?
Well, I have to say it started rather simply. What it turned into was not something I really had in mind when I started. And it really began as wondering if there were any music that expressed at a more basic human level the what it was like just to live in the camp, the life of the life in the camp, feelings people had, that kind of thing. And, you know, there was, it's well known that there's music by composers who were classically trained composers right. that wrote in the concentration camps. And in fact, you know, the Nazis actually used that music to make it look like everybody was happy. Mm-hmm. And, but most of that was instrumental. And the power of words is, or was really what I was looking for. Mm-hmm. And as a choral musician, one who works mostly in the choral art, I am a real lover of the African-American spiritual. Mm-hmm. I think that is an incredible expression of just really that whole era and what life was like, and expresses in a very deep way the emotions and thoughts of those people. And I was looking for that with regard to the Holocaust, because I really didn't think that there was much out there that expressed it in that way. So I guess in its very basic definition, it's really folk music, mm-hmm. music written by people, which may many of them have music training. Yeah. I'm not saying that, but they're not aspiring, quote-unquote, classical music mm-hmm. composers.
I certainly want to get into the nature of that music as you discovered it and the narrative texts that were used, and we will do that in a moment. But I'm curious about something else, even as you spoke, in that the project seemed to evolve in a sense or grow beyond your initial expectation. I hope I don't use too grand a verb here, but were you in the process of doing this, given the nature of the subject, in any sense transformed by it, changed by it, affected by it, I'm sure?
Yes. And I hope the effect it had on me is the effect it will have on people when they listen to it. But if I suppose, well, I should speak for myself, but I have a feeling a lot of people can put themselves in my shoes, that we all have little prejudices which are seemingly harmless. And I think I really had to examine those things as I worked with this. And I don't necessarily mean anti-Semitic, but of any kind, in the most seemingly innocent, oh, I'm just joking kind of way. And I'm not even talking about as overtly as a racial joke. I'm talking about things much more subtle than that, that I think you begin to get in touch with, you really have to re-examine how you think about the world and the people around you.
Yeah, quite frankly, that's a wonderful outcome. I mean, if it produces that kind of heightened sensitivity, I think you're quite right. There, there are layers that to which these things descend. They sort of permeate your being. You're not even aware of your attitudes until you examine them.
And I think that's the power of folk music in a way. It's you're really getting at the very core.
Right. Speaking of music, one of the things I've learned in sort of preparing myself for our conversation actually astounded me, that there were basically at least two types of music being played in the camps. The one we're going to focus on, of course, is the folk music and other forms. But also, and this is the part that really surprised me, the Nazis compelled many inmates to perform, essentially, to perform symphonies. I had never realized that that was going on. Well, given the barbarity, I suppose that's one of the milder things they did, but that was a fact.
Yeah, I'm not really an expert on the whole use of music in the camps, but certainly, I mean, music was used as torture. There were lullabies played over the PA system in the camps as children were being murdered or gassed, as mothers having to listen to it. I mean, all sorts of horrific things like that. There's a case that I found, it's not in the cantata, but literally dead people next to a Christmas tree being forced to sing Silent Night, and so they're making them have this kind of compulsory Christmas observation. And these obviously were probably Polish Catholics who were part of the intelligentsia or political prisoners or something like that.
My God. I mean, I guess there are no bounds.
No. And then, of course, Auschwitz had an orchestra, and they played for every roll call march, the orchestra would play. And in some ways, as a musician, I can tell you that if I had to play just to be able to hold my instrument, and I don't play the violin, but if I were a symphony musician, in some ways that allows you to be so close to the very thing you love, yet you're so incredibly far away from it, from what you're having to play and what you're having to play for. And again, it's just another level of the mm-hmm. absolute horror of it all, in a way.
Yeah. In a somewhat more, or at least less unhappy way, the music that you focused on for the cantata is, of course, largely the music that was generated within the camps, is that right, or inspired by that?
That's right.
That music. What's the nature of that music? You began to touch on this earlier, and I'd like to probe it a bit. Of course, in our own national history, slavery was the great evil, and the music that came through that was the spiritual and
right.
part of the slaves. Is that in any way akin to what you discovered?
Well, certainly not as... I should back up and say that all of these composers are Polish. So the cantata comes from that perspective. And that is because the collection that I looked at was a collection that was gathered by a man named Alexander Kuleshevitz, who was an inmate, a victim of the Holocaust. Or I should say he was incarcerated, but he did survive. And he devoted his life after the war to collecting poetry and music from people who wrote this music in the camps. And much of it was just by remembering it orally and writing it down and that kind of thing. There was one composer who's represented a lot, Józef Krupiński, who managed to write over 300 tunes or 300 songs in 2 years and snuck out of the camps when they were liberated with a lot of that music. So that's why we have a lot of that. So I think it has, there's even, I have snuck in a little portion of the Polish national anthem underneath
right.
a song of resistance, for instance. And so it I want to be clear that it has that bent. So I think in terms of answering your question, the emotions that are expressed, I think, are universal, and surely everyone in the camp was feeling them. But in terms of it expressing it for everybody in terms of non-Poles, not necessarily, mm-hmm. but I think the universal message is still there, certainly.
Well, as a listener, one listener, that being me, I think the universal message does come through quite powerfully.
Good.
I attest to that. You chose to orchestrate this for piano and cello.
Right.
Now, why was that choice made?
Well, the cello, I think, is the string instrument, or the instrument to me that is the closest to the human voice in a way. and also just literally how you caress the instrument. I mean, you know, some of these, maybe to talk about it almost sounds silly, but I think all of this goes into it, that it's a very, it's almost as though you're dancing with a partner if you see a cellist play and they're moving the instrument. And so I just thought that was a beautiful way to voice what wasn't being said, I guess. And the piano is a rather dramatic instrument. And as you will hear as you play some of these segments, this music is very definitely Eastern European. And it's very, that style that is somewhat melodramatic, you know. And the piano is a wonderful instrument for that because it has a great deal of amplitude possibilities. It can be very soft and very loud.
You know, my own quick personal reaction is that I fully agree with you about this kind of almost anthropomorphic quality of the cello. I mean, I know that, for example, I'm an admirer, like everyone else practically, of Yo-Yo Ma.
Right.
And it's interesting that the things he's done on television work wonderfully musically. They also work wonderfully visually because you have this sense of him and a partner.
Exactly right.
And the cello is the partner in that sense. The other thing about the cello, and you can correct me quickly if I'm wrong on this, is to me it's an instrument that conveys deep passion and really can convey a lament,
yes.
I think, more powerfully than almost anything else I can think of.
Yes. And the cello can play very low notes, literally low notes, and it can play very high. And I think when it gets into the high register, it really is as though it's a human being crying out in a way.
Well said. Let me take a break from our conversation, Donald, just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Donald McCullough, conductor of the Master Chorale of Washington and composer of the Holocaust Cantata. Well, music speaks for itself, so let's begin to hear an excerpt or two and talk about them of this. I'd like to begin where the cantata begins, by listening to the first segment or portion thereof, The Prisoner Rises. Heard a portion of the first piece, The Prisoner Rises. Why was it chosen?
Just something about beginning, The Prisoner Rises, he's getting up. It's kind of a subtle thing, but it just seemed like a nice place to start. And I should say, there's no plot to this. It's just little moments in time, and a reading would follow, and wouldn't have anything necessarily to do with this, although I think in spirit they're related. And one of the other things I tried to do was have it be somewhat educational, in that first song we just learned that straw rustles around him. We know a bit about how they were sleeping, although I think many of them didn't even have straw. Has coffee only, and ate his bread yesterday, so he doesn't have any today. Just giving people a sense of what life was like. And that's what they wanted to sing about.
Don, I'd like to turn to a different piece, a different mood, and a kind of a very different style of expression, because I think it's interesting for the listener to get a sense of the wide variety in the cantata. So it may come as a great surprise to those listening, but there is in the cantata a segment called Tempo di Tango.
Right.
Let's listen to it and talk about it.
Okay.
Thank you. very clearly a tango.
Yes.
There's no question about that. But a tango in a concentration camp.
Well, you know, there were actually a lot of tangos written by Kropinski, a composer I mentioned earlier, polonaises, all sorts of dance music, which I think was simply popular at the time. They were just writing what they were interested in and what they were hearing on the radio and listening to before, you know, they went to the camps. And the reading before this is rather fascinating, which is There's No Life Like Life at Auschwitz, which is a song that several drunk prisoners wrote, and it was their way of, you know, dealing with this through humor. And they were able to sneak into this cellar, which I don't quite have figured out, but it was a pump station, and they tricked the Nazis into thinking that Tokay was vinegar. And in fact, it's wine, and so they put it in this storage area, and through taping these pieces of pipe together and all of this, they ran it way down to this pump station, were able to go down there and have a good time and drink. And so the song is born, you know, There's No Life Like Life at Auschwitz, which, when listening to the cantata, this comes late, you really need the comic relief, frankly.
Yeah.
So this tango follows that, and we didn't have her get drunk. Miriam Bukowski's playing, but she's playing it in a style as though she were slightly tipsy.
This is a wonderful moment in the cantata, and you know, I, again, as one listener, I did appreciate it for all the reasons you've listed. That it's another aspect of life. It's the leavening of humor, and I didn't know this background you've just given us, but it's a wonderful story about the human spirit.
Absolutely.
It's really marvelous.
And the whole cantata, I guess the theme of the whole thing is really resistance.
Yeah.
And much of it's spiritual resistance. But, and that the power that plays.
Yeah. I want to go to another segment from the cantata right now, because it, as has been true of everything we've talked about, from Song of the Polish Prisoner with its expression of nationalism to Tempo di Tango, bringing forth the use of humor as a way of resisting, and it very much was. There's a piece here called The Train that I think reflects another human mood, and I think we might like to hear that now and talk about it.
Great.
There were 19 other teenaged girls from my town on the military bus that took us to a nearby camp to be examined by German doctors. Once we were declared healthy, SS soldiers escorted us to a waiting train and crammed us into a cattle car. Then, with a clanging jolt, the train began to roll us away from all that we loved so dearly to our new destination, Germany.
Two things about this segment. Here, Don, we hear what is frequently heard throughout the cantata, which is sort of a bit of narrative introduction, as well as at least a portion of the piece itself. I'd like you to briefly comment on this particular narrative and the use of narrative generally in the piece, and then the character of this particular piece, the train, because to my ears it sounded like my notes to myself say that this is a loving farewell in the face of tragedy, but then that's one man's reaction.
Well, I think that's right. And the narrative that leads up to this is actually the story of the mother of one of my singers in the Master Chorale Chamber Singers, who, when we premiered this work 2 years ago, and the Nazis came to her house and said, or to her mother's house and said, where's your daughter? And she happened to be away, and long story short, if you don't bring her to us, we're going to take you outside and shoot you. I mean, it was that simple. So they hit her for a while and realized that wasn't going to work, and so she went into slave labor and was part of that and survived. And so we use this very personal story, which is, of course, very meaningful to us as a part of this, and that's what leads into it. Now, she was put on a train, but this song doesn't really necessarily, again, relate to that specifically, but it certainly could. And I, the thing I like about the train is that I don't know exactly the circumstances, but some man is watching his young love or, get on a train and be sent away. And the power of a locomotive, you know, when you really think about it, and how futile it is, that there's nothing he can do. And if you've ever stood next to a train, you know how awesome that is. And this piece starts out very simply, but it becomes very dramatic. And I think for me, that's what was so meaningful. And I guess this really is at the apex of the piece. I mean, it is the centerpiece, the one that's the most emotionally powerful, I think, in terms of, or I should say, the most dramatic.
Where's this cantata been performed, Donald?
It's been performed twice. We premiered it 2 years ago at the Kennedy Center, Terrace Theater, and then the response was so positive to it, people asked us to do it again, so we did it again at the Kennedy Center. And I made some changes the second time around, which I think, you know, you always are fiddling with it a little bit until it feels, you don't really know until you perform something. And but the way we performed it the second time is how we recorded it.
That leads to the obvious question, also inspired in part by what you've told us a moment ago about one of your singers having such a personal relation to this. What kinds of reactions have you gotten from audience singers, all who've heard it?
The very first time we recorded, we performed this in a typical composerly fashion, I was faxing my cellist, you know, cello parts 4 days before the performance. I hadn't finished the tango. The choir had not heard the readings that came in between because I didn't want to spend rehearsal time on that when I could pull individuals aside and meet with them to rehearse their narrative readings. And so when we first performed this, I don't think anybody, including myself, was prepared for what it was going to be like because none of us had experienced it from beginning to end without interruption. And I can remember we went backstage after that first performance and we all just stood there and stared at one another. And then, you know, the hugging began, but it was just an incredibly profound experience. And I have never in my life received so many cards and letters and notes from people as I did, which was very meaningful to me and which was, you know, said to me that it did what I hoped it would do.
Did any of that response come from those who had lived through the experience?
No, although the second performance, I know that there were people that had lived through the experience that were there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's many times they don't wish to talk about it.
Yeah, I imagine. The reason I asked that question was that I think in something I read about this piece or your composition of it, there's a quote from one of them, singing saved my life, which I thought was, I mean, that was, that's in four words, what?
Yeah, that's one of the readings, actually, and is a man talking about just the ability to be allowed to sing. Now, much of this was done in secret, and if the political prisoners, their camps, I don't think were as closely guarded, and that's how they were able to get away with a lot of that. But yes, I think for many people, it absolutely did. It just, I mean, music is... That's why I do this. I mean, I'm in the soul business, you know, and there are all sorts of problems we have in the world, people without insurance and all of that. But there are people with insurance and plenty of money who I think also have to be fed at some level and so that they remain productive members of society. And that's feeding the soul, and that's what, to me, choral music does, because I think it's so powerful because it has words. And
it's probably, that's such a beautiful statement, I shouldn't probably say anything, but, but I have to ask you a question that actually inspired by what you've just said to conclude this conversation. I look forward to talking to you on another occasion about other aspects of this wonderful piece. But because you are in the soul business, and music, the music you compose, the music the chorale sings, is designed to have an effect on people. And quite frankly, that's, I think, another thing to emphasize here, that we're talking about the suffering of a set of people at a given time. But I think there is, once again, a universal aspect to this. No one should feel excluded from this topic or feel that they are not part of it. And because of that, Donald McCullough, what do you want the audience to take away? I mean, what if you had to say your musical bottom line, what is it?
Well, if they can remember, and what I want them to remember is not only who suffered, but more importantly, that people just like them were a part of the reality of this thing, that if we don't keep that part of our human nature in check, which is capable of things that are horrific, I mean, this really isn't a, those people could do that, but I certainly never could. I think we're all quite capable in the right circumstances. And I guess that's one of the things that I found was most meaningful to me. And I think what I want people to take away from this is to really examine what role they play, no matter how small, in making certain this never happens again and making certain that on no level are they a part of it. And I think by getting to know people, which the cantata really kind of allows you to do, real people, we have the best chance of perhaps that happening.
I move to say amen.
Thank you.
Thank you for the cantata, and thank you for this conversation.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Donald McCullough, conductor of the Master Chorale of Washington and composer of the Holocaust Cantata. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed, our technical director is John Tyler, and our production assistant is Kirsten LaCour-Dabelko. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.